Well, thank you for coming in. I'm glad we could arrange it on rather short notice.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here.
I always look at the back of the book to read about the author, and
there's not much there.
Not much there, so I was intrigued a little bit. I'd like to know a little bit about yourself, where you're from and all that. Where were you born?
I was actually born in Ontario, in Canada, when my father was sort of in romantic exile. He divorced a woman, or was trying to divorce a woman, but if he lived within the United States, he would have to pay her exorbitant amounts of money. So he left the country, and that's why, and with another woman, and that's why I was born in Canada. And then he came back in the country. I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware,
mm-hmm.
and left Wilmington when I was 17 and lived in Rhode Island for many years. So, and now I'm living in Massachusetts.
So you're living in Cape Cod?
Yes.
And it says here that you teach writing. Where mm-hmm. are you teaching? What are you doing?
Well, right now I'm not teaching, but I've been teaching when I was living in North Carolina recently at Warren Wilson College in North Carolina, and I've taught at Rhode Island College. I've done a lot of adjunct teaching,
mm-hmm.
but right now I'm just writing.
Where did you go to school?
I went to undergraduate college at Roger Williams College in Rhode Island, and then I went to the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa many years ago.
Many years ago?
Yeah.
Couldn't be that long.
Well, quite a while ago.
Well, that's a... Okay. That's a wonderful workshop at Iowa, isn't it? I mean, so many famous people have gone through it.
Yes, it's an intense program, and when I was there, I was a single mother. In my experience, it was quite different. And actually, I was holding a job. I was a corrections officer in Iowa, and so I had a very different experience from some of the other graduate students at the time.
Yeah, you've worked all that into the novel a little bit, huh?
Oh, that my prison experience was indelible. I couldn't resist writing about it in some way.
Yeah, that could be a topic for another book, huh?
Perhaps. I toyed with the idea one time of writing a book called Confessions of a Female Corrections Officer. And these confessions, of course, had highly political situations, because to be a woman working in the prison system is quite difficult. And it's not really the inmates that cause problems, but the old boy network of male corrections officers. At least this was so in Iowa many years ago.
What were some of the things that happened?
Well, the male corrections officers that I worked with really didn't believe women had, a woman like me could fit into the prison system, because, number one, I wasn't an out-and-out dykey woman, and I wasn't a very feminine, mousy woman. I was a real woman, and I had, a personality that just wasn't passive enough to be molded into that kind of framework. And the framework being, I was supposed to be quite willing to shoot somebody at any given moment, and I never really wore that well. And it was a difficult sexist environment.
How long did you... Just put this back just a little bit.
Okay.
No, you're okay.
Okay.
How long did you work in the prison system?
About a year only.
Now, this is while you were going to...
This is
to
while
Iowa?
I was a graduate student, and I had a daughter... And to support at the time. And I also, I've worked many jobs.
Some of the other jobs you've had.
It's really not that, the regular jobs that single women have to do. I was a Kelly girl. I was a waitress. I worked in a bookstore. I worked in a bank in credit card operations. Every kind of job that I could be paid a paycheck for. And I didn't really have as bad a time as a lot of women, probably. And then I started teaching part-time at the university level for, low pay, but at least it was an environment I felt more comfortable in.
What was it like growing up in Wilmington?
Wilmington's an interesting town because it's right over the Mason-Dixon line, and it's Wilmington, when I grew up, was known as the chemical capital of the world. It had several chemical companies, DuPont being the big one, but it had Atlas Chemical and Dow and several other companies. It was a big, booming industrial town. But I, you know, it was like a regular small town America for me.
Mm-hmm. Was your family literary as you
no.
grew up?
No.
What did your father do?
My father actually, he worked in the steel industry for most of his life, and his last job was as a supplier of industrial supplies.
Did your family read?
Oh yeah. My family isn't dumb, but they nobody was you would call literary, I guess.
Well, see, in my family, they weren't dumb either. I wouldn't really say they read, though. I mean,
yeah.
I could say I grew up with the
nobody
great books.
Nobody really read.
I always had the Reader's Digest condensed books around me when I.
Yeah,
that's their level.
I had
their level.
That's the level. I had that, but there were other books on the bookshelves, and there was an encouragement towards maybe artistic endeavor this way or that way. But I don't believe that I'm a writer because I was, you know, encouraged to be a writer. I think I'm a writer because of the mysteries and tragedies that come from family life, and the way I deal with them or incorporate them is to write about them. Other people become, you know, workaholics in their business world or whatever. But I don't know what caused me to write.
When did you first recognize an impulse to want to write?
Well, I was writing as a teenager. I published my first poems in a Harper and Row anthology of teenage writers during the 60s. And I thought, gee, this is easy. I can write these poems, and I can make almost $800 for them. That was one of the biggest amounts of money at that time I'd ever seen when I was 17. And then, of course, I decided that maybe I would continue to do this. But, you know, that question, everybody always asks painters or writers, you know, how did you start? And I think it's a way of observing and having to discover what happens in a life rather than just accepting it and not thinking about it. I think too much about things. And, you know, some people like to bury things, and I'm always dredging up memory and dredging up family trouble. And I think that writing about it is a risk, and it's painful at times, but it's not a pain that isn't somehow rewarding or healthy.
Family Night. Tell me a little bit about how this book came about, how you conceived of it.
Okay. Well, Family Night is about a man who never knew his father, and his father had abandoned his mother really before the man was born. And the father was a model for Arrow Collars. And he had a lot of photographs of his father, even though he had never met them. He had a lot of print ads and things. And so in my own family, I have a brother who never knew his father. And I thought it was such an evocative story and such a mysteriously vivid story that I witnessed unfolding in my own family, that it just sort of encouraged me to explore it. And when I wrote the book, it's not about my family, because in my family nobody ever went and looked for the estranged parent. But in the book, I have the characters getting together to really locate this estranged parent and really confront him. And a lot of people have told me, oh, that's the story of my father. And I think a lot of men and women, you know, have a parent who has left and they don't know what happened to them, or they feel haunted by that absence their whole lives.
Isn't that a coincidence? Mona Simpson's novel, The Lost Father, was published last year, just came out this week in paperback.
And it's, oh, really?
It's also about a search for a father. Almost. But the characters in her novel weren't quite as dysfunctional as the ones in yours.
No.
You have a trio of people. They really are dysfunctional. There's Tracy, Margaret's boyfriend, and Margaret's brother, Cam. They have a strange relationship among them. Maybe you could talk to me about that a little
bit. Well, it's a sexual triangle.
Yeah.
That's basically what it is.
It's obvious, and you set this up, and it, of course it reaches a culmination toward the end, but it's obvious that Margaret and Cam did have some sort of sexual interest.
Mm-hmm. She had a romantic interest in her stepbrother. Again, he was not a blood relative, but they grew up together and were close as brother and sister. And I think that Margaret admires and loves her brother and almost sees in him a refuge from her own erotic disasters and her own romantic debacles that she's had in her life. And she feels empathy for his search for his father. But I think that she sort of gloms on to his struggle to avoid addressing her own difficult divorce and mothering of her child. And because of the psychological intimacy of the search, when you have intimacy through friendship and familial love, what keeps it from crossing over into physical intimacy? And it's really kind of interesting to think of incest between consensual adults. Today, we read about, you know, incest as abuse and, you know, incest as wrongdoing by an older member of the family and towards a younger member. But I think it's kind of peculiar to have adult siblings perhaps cross over this line. I'm not saying it's acceptable, but I'm saying I'm surprised that it doesn't occur more often in the world when everybody's so alienated. Why not turn to a family member who you've been intimate with for your whole life and whom has great affection for you and concern for you? And if you get involved in a situation that's gravely difficult or harrowing, such as confronting this very horrible man that they go and find, it seems that maybe something could happen like this. Not that it's acceptable.
Right, but at the same time, I wonder if this familiar intimacy would create just the opposite effect. If you grow up with somebody and a family member, it's kind of hard for me to conceive having
right.
any kind of romantic notion toward that family member. Usually just the
of
opposite.
Of course, yeah. because they're completely revealed to you, and of course eroticism requires mystery. Well, there is a great deal of mystery, though, between these two, because there's enough separation in their lives that this mystery can be encouraged, and it can, you know, explode at the end. Of course, usually family members are so comfortable with one another in the way that we're used to it, that there would never be this blossoming. But maybe that's because they have good relationships in their lives, good marriages, good family relationships. Well, in these characters, their family lives are really wrecked. I mean, they're coming off of divorces. They have parental figures who are unloving and perhaps lost in their own miseries and losses, so they're not really standing square when all of this happens to them.
Strangely, Cameron seems to be consumed with guilt over this encounter with Margaret, but Margaret doesn't have a sense
right.
of guilt.
I think Cam is the one who is trying always to make the moral decision, and I think Margaret, this is a very politically incorrect book. And I think this is something that's funny about it, because in the 90s, people don't really write about women like Margaret. She's sort of passive. She lets the men run her life. She lets her lover do things to her. They're really verge on rape, and she doesn't leave him. And she sort of is at the, she's sort of doing anything to keep these men surrounding her. And so she's sort of odd in that way, because women aren't supposed to be like that. But in truth, many women are incapable of pulling themselves out of the quagmire of male dominance, you know. And so it's a risk, I think, to portray a character like her if somebody believes that the writer's condoning that kind of behavior in Margaret. But really, she's very she's damaged goods, and she can't quite pull herself out of it until the end. And I think she does. She's beginning to pull herself out of it at the end.
Tracy, now, Tracy, it does border on being a psychopath, doesn't it?
I don't know. I don't really know what the definition of psychopath is. He's definitely sexually dysfunctional in the sense that he uses sex as power, and he uses sex as a way of demeaning people. As it says in the book, he joined the organization Sex Anonymous, not that he has any intention of letting it help him. It's more just to really find out more about the wrong avenues of sex. And he's a funny character because he's bouncy and argumentative, and I think very funny at times, but he is a dangerous character because he pulls people into dangerous moments. And I think he and Cam together are a funny mix because they're very opposite, and yet there's some underlying connection, whether it be just that they're both male and whatever that means, or if it's Margaret that brings them close and more, you know, sort of like one another. I don't know, but it's a hopefully the three of them expose one another in ways that are interesting.
When you wrote Family Night, did you have a pretty good idea about where this book was going and how it was going to end?
Well, I knew that I wanted the characters to succeed in finding the estranged parent and to confront that parent. But, as a writer, you don't know really the way the story will go exactly, and you find moments where you discover something that you weren't aware of, things that you didn't know you knew. I mean, certainly you can't write something that you don't know because you can't pull it out of the air. But you can have discovery where you find out that you actually have a meaning drifting around that you never had recognized or welcomed, a meaning that is suddenly very important. And I think in that sense, as the novel progressed and things started to happen as far as plot and the story went from A to B to C, psychological pictures were drawn as well as just a movement of the plot. And this was exciting to find these, you know, characters. Because characters are emerging continuously until you shut the page, the last page. These characters keep emerging and keep hopefully becoming real all the way to the end.
Well, this is your first book. What did it feel like when you finally saw a first copy of Family Night?
Well, I think it looks great. I think the cover designer made a great cover with the three of them on the front. It looks very film noir and seems very forbidding, like something bad is going to happen. And it's a great, wonderful thing when a book is suddenly there in the physical world and it's no longer just swimming around in your mind, but it's actually there, you know, in paper. But that's my first novel, but I have published books of poetry and stories. But this novel has always wanted to be born. And I remember years ago, before writing this particular novel, I would think to myself, I've got to tell that story. And then eventually I had the time and the space and the ability to really begin it.
What's life like in Truro? That's on Cape Cod.
Right. Well, I just moved back there. I was living in Dixie for a while.
Dixie?
North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I'm very happy to be back in the Northeast because I'm a real Yankee. And I was really I wasn't in my home terrain in North Carolina. As much as I tried, it's a beautiful state, but I always felt like a Yankee mm-hmm. in the South. So where I am now, I'm trying to get some more work done. It's very quiet, and I'm trying to
do a house.
Yeah, I have a little house and right on the National Seashore.
Are you married?
Yes.
And you, how old is your daughter?
I have a daughter in college,
mm-hmm.
and I have a son in first grade. So I have a grown-up kid and a little kid.
In first grade?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy, you really have an age difference, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, by the time my son is in college, if he goes, or if he goes into the Navy or something, I will have been doing it for 30 years.
What does your husband do?
He's the executive director of the Fine Arts Work Center mm-hmm. in Provincetown, which is an arts organization.
I like Cape Cod a lot. I used to go almost every summer. I haven't been for a couple
Where
of years.
Where did you used to go?
We went to Chatham.
It's beautiful there.
Yeah. And
that's right on the elbow. That's where it gets foggy all the time because the sea just comes right over you.
My alma mater, Ohio University, has a theater there.
Oh. Huh.
Which was funded by the mm-hmm. former university president and his wife, who had a summer home in Chatham. So they have an ongoing, what is it called? I can't remember the name of it, but it's...
I'm not familiar with that.
But there's a theater there. It's mm-hmm. a summer stock is what it is.
Right.
And so I used to go almost every August to mm-hmm. see whatever they had and to camp out and this sort of thing. So that was nice. Well, tell me what's ahead for Maria Fluke.
Well, I'm working on a new novel, and that's coming along well. And I have a collection of stories, which hopefully will be appearing sometime soon. And but the new novel takes place in Newport, Rhode Island, and where I lived for many, many years. And it's about the other side of Newport, not the glitzy... side, the rich Yahtzee side, but the year-rounder side, the side, the dark sort of lower class Newport, which nobody knows exists really. And so hopefully I'll have that in going pretty well soon.
Well, Family Night is a beautiful piece of work, and I certainly enjoyed reading it, and I appreciate that you had time to come in and talk to me about it.
Well, thank you, Don.
Thank you.